From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. On the show today, CASAs, court-appointed special advocates, are volunteers from the community who are trained to represent the interests of children who have been removed from their homes because of abuse or neglect. We learn why the program's facing a critical shortage of volunteers and what we can do to help. But first, on August 8th, the state of Louisiana moved to vacate Cedric Dent after he spent 25 years in prison for a fatal shooting he did not commit. Mr. Dent had been convicted of the murder of Anthony A. Milton in 1997, but the verdict was non-unanimous. At the time, Louisiana allowed cases to be decided by divided juries, which has since been deemed unconstitutional. Cedric Dent joins us today to share more about his case, wrongful convictions, and the importance of getting innocent people out of prison. Thanks for being here, Cedric.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Cedric. Good to have you on. Of course, when you were released, you were met outside the Louisiana State Penitentiary by family who stood by you during your more than two decades behind bars. We're also joined now by your mom, Miss Erlaine Brooks Colbert. Miss Erlaine, thanks for being here.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure and honor.
And finally, also with us is Meredith Engelson, Director of Special Projects at the Innocence Project in New Orleans, who helped in the case of Cedric's exoneration. Meredith, thank you.
Very happy to be here.
Can we start by getting a bit of background on this case? Cedric, what exactly was the story the prosecution told that led to your conviction?
This fresh evidence, they had evidence on me. 1997, they had a district attorney, Harry Connie Jr. He held evidence on me, withhold evidence, and he just messed up my life. You know, I wasn't even supposed to be locked up. You know, and a witness saying that they saw me kill someone, the lone eyewitness who testified in my behalf.
And of course, the truth was you were actually at the movies that night, an alibi that was somehow never presented to the jury. Why was that? Why were there so many missteps in this trial? And maybe Meredith, you can speak to that.
So when Cedric turned himself in because he had heard that he was wanted for a crime that he knew nothing about, he told the police, "I was at the movies that night." And the police did tell that story at the trial, but the lawyer representing him did not do anything to show further proof that that's where he was. The police never investigated or tried to corroborate that that's where he was. And so while that statement was out there, the witness who testified said that he was very sure he had the right person. And so it ended up being basically his word against what Cedric said. So they believed the eyewitness. What we learned in our investigation was that the eyewitness had actually given six different statements about his opportunity to see the shooter, each time becoming more and more certain that it was the right person, each time giving a longer story about how much he had interacted with the shooter before the shooting. Whereas the first story he told was, it happened in a dark lot. I turned around and saw somebody pointing a gun in my face and then they ran away. So the statements that the witness had given earlier showing that his story had evolved so much, those never came into the trial. But what the jury ended up hearing was from one witness who sounded very sure that he had pointed to the right person.
Erlaine, how I can't even imagine what this was like for you. I'm sure that initially, that moment's met with grief that your child is behind bars and he's telling you he's innocent. But how did you turn that grief into fighting to get him out of prison?
I never stopped praying. I never stopped trusting and thanking God. I never stopped serving. And I'm not saying it was easy a lot of times. Very, very hard. Very hard. But I never gave up hope.
Can you tell me what the process was for you? How did you find out he was being charged with this crime? How did he communicate to you? that he was innocent?
He told me. He said, Mama, I'm innocent. I didn't do that. And I believed my child then, and I believe him now.
Meredith, I want to pivot to you. Can you tell us a little bit about the Innocence Project New Orleans and the kind of work that you do?
So we have represented now 41 people who have been freed from wrongful conviction for crimes they did not commit. We work in Louisiana, across the state. The way our intake system works is people write to us. And unfortunately, we have thousands of people who have written to us, and obviously we do not have the resources to investigate everybody's case. And so Cedric wrote to us in 2009, and we were not able to start work on his case until 2020. And when we did, it became clear pretty quickly that the evidence against him, even the state's version of the evidence, was very thin. We also found police notes that made clear that there had been an additional witness who had seen what had happened, had described a person who did not match Cedric's description. We found that the eyewitness who did testify had originally given a description of the shooter that did not match Cedric.
And of course, this isn't the first time someone in Cedric's family has been wrongfully convicted. His uncle, Elvis Brooks, served 42 years for a killing connected to an armed robbery and was also exonerated with the help of the Innocence Project. Can you, Meredith, tell us what happened there and what this says about our criminal justice system, that there were two wrongful convictions in one family?
So Elvis Brooks was arrested for murder and armed robbery that happened in a bar that was dimly lit. He was identified by some white strangers in a lineup. He became a suspect simply because he was a black man who lived in the neighborhood. The actual robbers had left fingerprints behind. Those fingerprints were never examined until Innocence Project New Orleans got involved, and they showed that they were not his fingerprints and he couldn't have done the robbery or the murder. So he was released from prison in 2019.
We're speaking with the recently exonerated Cedric Dent, his mother, Erlaine Brooks Colbert, and Director of Special Projects at the Innocence Project New Orleans, Meredith Engels. And Cedric, all this time, the last 25 years, what was the kind of work that you were doing to get your conviction overturned?
Just I stayed focused. I never gave up. You know, I'm innocent. Just work on my legal case. And
you found Brady evidence, Cedric.
Yes,
in 2008.
Brady. Yes.
What's this now?
Found Brady evidence in 2008. Contradicted witness statements, and Eric Connick Jr. Hid from me. I was cold trial during my procedures, motion hearings and stuff.
So you were doing your own investigation behind bars to prove your innocence. And Ms. Erlaine,
yes.
I know that you two, you work together as well, I'm thinking. I mean, how do families and lawyers work with each other in these kinds of cases?
Being available, being honest, being, I could say, persistent, and trust. The Innocence Project of New Orleans, the Promise Justice Initiative advocates, I consider these and others to be our angels. And they have proven that over and over and over again. And I am just so thankful and so grateful for them. They never gave up. And that encouraged me more so not to give up. And we know sometimes it don't happen overnight. It don't happen in a day. Sometimes years. And it did take years. But it has finally happened.
And Meredith, so there are many people that you're working with. How does that relationship work? You come into families that are in a terrible situation.
Cedric filed his own post-conviction petition in 2009 because he had made his own request to the DA for his file and found evidence in there that should have been disclosed to his lawyer. He, with the help of inmate counsel, filed a petition that showed, laid all of this out and did a great job. But somehow that petition never made it to the court. Nobody ruled on it. And when we were looking through his case, we realized that there was no proof that this had ever been mailed and filed. And we talked through it and said, you know, you should still be able to make these claims if you filed this, but we don't have any proof that you did. And he said, I saved the proof of mailing for that day. And he had the proof of mailing and was able to show to the court, yes, I did send this in on the right day, and you still need to consider my claim. So that was part of the whole package, and that was based on his good work and his diligence and his good record keeping.
Well, from all of you, what was your reaction when you learned Cedric would be released? And Cedric, now that you're out, where do you go from here?
My attorney, Ms. Merritt, just told me, wonderful feeling, you know, it was finally over with. His marriage is his God gift to the world. Yes, it was a good feeling. I appreciate everything, and I know I put God first. You know, without him, none of this would have been possible. I just appreciate that, you know, gaining my freedom back. Being with my family, my daughter was 2, my son was 7 months old when I got incarcerated. The adults now, my daughter have a grandson, so I got a grandson. Just want to be with them and, you know, and work and just be with family. I want to live the rest of my life.
Miss Earlene, can you tell us what it was like for you to hear that your son, after 25 years, was going to be free?
That is the day that I prayed for and looked so much forward to, and for it to actually come into fruition Monday. Wow, what a blessing. What a blessing. Going up there many years and leaving without my son. But on August the 8th, 2022, left with my son. I was so glad to see my child and hug him and walk away from the Louisiana State Penitentiary and go. And I'm just so grateful. I am so grateful and thankful. And I just want to tell a story, because if this is going to help somebody, I want it to be known. We want it to be known.
Well, you know, yeah. I think it would be fitting to wrap this conversation with any advice for those that are in the same position, for our family members who are advocating for someone wrongfully convicted. We'll start with you, Ms. Earlene. Well, we've been speaking with the recently exonerated Cedric Dent, his mother, Earlene Brooks Colbert, and Director of Special Projects at the Innocence Project New Orleans, Meredith Engelson. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. They don't wear capes, at least most of the time, but they are heroes to many abused and neglected children living in foster care who need someone to advocate for them in court. CASAs, court-appointed special advocates, are volunteers from the community who are trained to represent the interests of children who've been removed from their homes because of abuse or neglect. CASA faces a volunteer shortage at a time when the need is the greatest. Joining me to talk about that need and what they do are Capital Area CASA Executive Director Allison Trexler and Program Manager Jacqueline Wilson. Just a warning to our listeners, the story contains mentions of child abuse and neglect. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
I know, Allison, you're stepping into some pretty big shoes as the new leader of CASA. Liz Betts, who has been the head for nearly 30 years, is stepping down at the end of August. Could you give us some idea of the size of this organization? I know this the chapter that you represent is the capital area CASA, but there are CASA chapters all over the state and actually all over the United States.
Yes, correct. Here in Louisiana, we have 17 offices that are throughout the parishes. There are 950 CASA programs throughout 49 states. And I believe the last time I checked, they have been maybe 93,000 volunteers that have been serving since the beginning of CASA, which was in 1976, so 40 years.
Wow, that's a lot of people giving time and heart to see children helped. Jacqueline, you're the program manager there at the Capital Area CASA. Could you give us an idea of the need? How many children do CASA serve per year? And what are some of the examples of the types of situation in which a child needs someone to advocate for them?
Well, on average, we serve about 300 children a year. Today, as I sit with you, we're serving 208 children with 123 volunteers, which is a lot. But unfortunately, we still have about 80 kids that are waiting. Prior to the pandemic, we were actually serving and very proud to be serving 100% of children in foster care in East Baton Rouge Parish. That is our service area. But with the pandemic, it became much more difficult to recruit volunteers for our training classes. So we've had several very small training classes. We have children in foster care because of neglect. We have children in foster care because a sibling of the child has been killed by the parent. We have where the parent has been killed. We have serious sexual abuse, serious physical abuse as well. It just runs the spectrum of types of abuse that these children are suffering. But all the kids we serve are abused and neglected as determined by the court and are placed, and most of them in foster home settings, but in some kind of foster placement.
And Allison, what do CASA volunteers do that's a benefit to these children? What's the role of a CASA volunteer?
A CASA volunteer does not have to have any social work or any type of background. They just need to be 21 years of age, have a heart for children, and go through a pretty intense 32-hour training class held at our office here in Baton Rouge. The CASA volunteers are then assigned to a case, and they are truly the eyes and ears for the judge. The only thing that they want is the best for that child. So they advocate for the child. They are sworn in when they become a CASA by the juvenile judge courts, and they are they're expected to see the child, get to know the family, the parents, the foster families, the teachers, the medical professionals. If there is something the child needs, they can advocate for the child to receive that.
And Jacqueline, I know you've spoken with many, many volunteers in your more than 20 years there at CASA. What are you hearing is the most common reservation that people have and tend to overcome to actually become a volunteer? Allison, you mentioned the effect the pandemic has had on the ranks of volunteers at CASA and on the number of children needing an advocate. Statistics tell us that summer months are typically a time when a lot of abuse and neglect goes unnoticed, but we're in a season when there's back to school. What do you anticipate with us, with the kids going back to school, that you'll find in terms of abuse, neglect, and needs for more volunteers at CASA?
Yes, you're absolutely correct that when children throughout the pandemic had been home and homeschooling and with their family or their relatives, there was, from what we can tell, somewhat of an increase when they went back to school. Unfortunately, the fact that a CASA needs to be face-to-face, they need to put their eyes on the living arrangements. And that was very hard during the pandemic. Our team did so much virtually, Zoom, FaceTime, socially distanced visits with the CASA child outside. They really leapt into action, making sure the kids had internet And so all of that, just like everyone in the world, had to change the way that they did their work. We still have people who are a little apprehensive to go into other people's homes or into a school or a medical setting to advocate for a child. And, you know, you can imagine we have a lot of retired folks, people that have the time to commit, and they were a little more worried about getting out. So it's coming back slowly. Unfortunately, like you said, the number of children who are needing CASAS seems to be rising.
And as you said, there is a waiting list. So there are actually children right now that don't have a CASA volunteer that need a CASA volunteer. Jacqueline, is there a story from a CASA volunteer that you can share? A story about their experience, the effect it's had on them and on a child that they've served?
There are so many stories, Karen, but I'm trying to pinpoint it to just one. But this is an opportunity really for people who are saying somebody needs to do something about this. This is an opportunity for somebody, a lay person from the community, to come in and do something for one child. So they monitor the child in the foster home, how things are going. If things are not going well there, they can advocate for remediation of the foster home or even removal from a foster home. They advocate in the school system for the children, they advocate in the court system and with social services. So essentially, you have a person who becomes an expert in that child. And everyone in the system looks to the CASA to know more of the details about that particular child. And it's the details that help us advocate for what is in the child's best interest.
Jacqueline, you're program manager. What's the next step if someone's listening right now and they're like, okay, I want to do something? What do they need?
You can go to CASABR.org and sign up for an orientation. We have a 45-minute orientation session where we go through what it really entails to be a CASA volunteer, because we want to give people the best information we can to make the best decision for themselves, whether or not this is a volunteer experience that they are interested in. Or they can call the office at 379-8598 to register for one of the orientation sessions.
Yes. The other thing that you may discover that it's not for you right now, but we are totally willing and available to come to offices, corporations, churches, civic associations, and speak. If I could speak for 30 minutes, an hour, and we can get one volunteer, just think of the impact that that can make. We can put stories in advertisements in church bulletins or company newsletters. Flyers. We can hang a flyer, you know, anywhere. And so the kind of grassroots way, we have discovered that the best way to get other people to become CASAS is word of mouth. Liz has even said, I'll come back. I'm going to be retired. If I need to go speak on behalf of CASA, I'll do it. So This team really wants to see that wait list eliminated soon, really soon.
CASA Executive Director Allison Traxler and Program Manager Jacqueline Wilson, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Thank you to our guests, Cedric Dent, Earlene Brooks Cobert, and Director of Special Projects at the Innocence Project New Orleans, Meredith Engelson. Thanks also to CASA Executive Director Allison Trexler and Program Manager Jacqueline Wilson. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber, our digital editor Caitlin Omholtz. Our engineers are Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Procell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at 12 noon and 7:30 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from the Historic New Orleans Collection.